Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with the legendary Vince Cerf, really a polymath icon who's continuing to be a catalyst for global innovation and change. Vince, you've just got so many outstanding global contributions in so many different areas, and thank you for coming in today and sharing so much with our audience.
Well, one is glad to be of service, pretending for a moment that this is actually of service, so we'll find out by the end of the interview.
Now, Vint, you have so many recognitions throughout your career. Are there any that stand out to you, and why?
Well, as you say, there are a lot. Let me pick on a few for primarily thematically for their geographic dispersion. So the Presidential Medal of Freedom meant a lot to me because it's the highest civilian recognition you can get here in the United States. And the National Medal of Technology, similarly, it's not awarded to a great many different people, and that's another presidentially awarded thing. But the Queen Elizabeth Prize for Engineering was especially satisfying for two reasons. First, you had a chance to meet Queen Elizabeth face-to-face, you know, and I think a lot of people could probably say that they've done that. The monarch is unbelievably well-traveled and in her 80s and extremely well-preserved, let me put it that way, and quite friendly. So that was a real thrill. But on top of that, a prize for engineering as opposed to science, for example, or mathematics or something of those sorts, that was especially gratifying because engineers often don't get a lot of visibility. The Prince of Asturias Award comes from Spain, and it is awarded by the then Prince of Spain. Now that the Prince, former Prince of Spain, has become the King of Spain, his sister Princess offers the Princess of Asturias Award Prize every year, and it's a very broadly based prize. It goes from social activities, sports, to scientific works and things of that kind, the literature and the like. And finally, the Japan Prize, and this one is awarded by, in a ceremony with the Emperor and the Empress of Japan. So these are all striking and stunning and unexpected honors among many others. And their diversity and their geographic spread, I think, tells you that Internet has touched many people in many places.
You know, that's just a great description of some of the prizes you've received or awards and recognitions. Now, you're just the immediate past president of the ACM, the Association for Computing Machinery. And it just reminds me that there's so many of these international societies which have fairly big memberships, and ACM is one of them. However, there's, you know, some estimates, maybe 50, even more, perhaps even 100 million people working in technology in some way, and especially in computing. How can the ACM address some of the challenges they're facing? In addition to that, how they can they continue to be grow and be inclusive and meet the needs of the global community?
Well, there are several challenges that ACM and others of its ilk face. One of them is establishing business models that will work in the 21st century. And, of course, it's very clear that online publication and open access have become extremely important themes and subject of debate because the business models that go with them are not yet fully established. And so there's a big issue there. One needs to go even farther to think about the archiving and curation of digital publications and the data that goes with them, if there is any, and the metadata, and maybe even the software and the models that are used to analyze that data. And this applies not only in the computing discipline, but in other disciplines in physics and chemistry and biology and so on, because so many of those have become great, huge consumers of computing capability, with modeling especially, or measurement and analysis being a part of the research. So the ability to hang on to all of that digital information and make it accessible over periods of hundreds of years or more is a huge challenge. There is also a question of being relevant to practitioners. Historically, ACM has been made up of people who have, the membership anyway, has been made up of people who are conducting research in the space of computer science and its application. But it's the people who actually write code that gets used by others who are building businesses and building applications that we would like to reach. And in fact, we suspect we do reach a great many of them, but they don't choose to become members because maybe they don't have to. They manage to get to our conferences. They may have access to our publications through libraries. So reaching the practitioners may actually turn out to be our biggest challenge, and we think there are millions of them compared to the 100,000 or so official members that we have at ACM. And finally, not to suggest that there are only three challenges, these are just three that I'm picking up in particular, and that's the promotion of computer science as a discipline. What we would like, frankly, is to get younger people more interested in computer science. I'd like everybody graduating from high school to have had at least some exposure to programming, not because I think they should all become programmers, but because I want them to understand the world that they're living in, and that world is filled with software, increasingly so. I want them to understand how it works and how it doesn't work and why it doesn't work and what bugs are all about and how hard it is to find them and what vulnerabilities can cost you in the form of hazards, where somebody exploits a vulnerability and does some bad thing to remove your data or to do identity theft or carry out some other nefarious scheme. I want people to be more aware of how that works so that they can be more conscious of protecting themselves. So those are just examples of the kinds of challenges that I think ACM should be addressing in the course of the 21st century's evolution.
Well, those are some very fine sort of challenges that you brought up with respect to the ACM, and I know you're going to continue to help support the ACM as they move forward because you still sit on their council as past president. But I guess somewhat related to this is the ACM is involved in many areas and domains of computing, and you yourself are essentially a founder of the Internet, the original Internet. What do you see as some top challenges and controversies that we see, face with the Internet, and especially in the next 10 years? And do you have any possible solutions?
Yeah, well, let's see. First of all, I'm going to lump three things together as one. So we're going to count this as one, and that's safety, security, and privacy, and all of which are, in some sense, at risk in the current very, very global Internet spread. And the reason for that, again, is that software is vulnerable. It has mistakes in it. People exploit those mistakes, and they use that to do all kinds of nefarious things. And so we have a major challenge in front of us just to make the Internet safer to use, more private, and also more secure. That is achievable. It means that we're going to have to do a better job of software development. We're going to have to make better use of cryptographic methods. We need to make strong authentication the normal practice. We need to make two-factor authentication a preferred way of authenticating as opposed to just usernames and passwords. So, I mean, these are essential challenges because if people don't feel safe using the Internet, or if in particular if they are not safe using the Internet, then it may not, in fact, be around in the next 10 years because people will have discarded it as an unsafe environment, either for privacy reasons or for security reasons and confidentiality in the business context. So that's one big, big challenge. The second one is the preservation of digital information. You know, we go to all this trouble to take the real world information in physical form, whether it's books or images and so on, and we digitize them thinking that we're doing something wonderful because the digital bits don't degrade in the same way that the physical media do, except for the fact that they might, in fact, degrade. The medium on which the bits are stored may not be readable in the future, either because the bits themselves have disintegrated on the medium, like a polycarbonate DVD, or we don't have a reader anymore that knows how to read that particular physical format. And that's the more common problem, that within a few years' time, many of these storage media don't work anymore because we don't have a reader, or there's no interface for, the USB of 2010. So that's a problem. But the worst problem is that in order to correctly interpret bits that we have successfully saved, we may need to have the applications and the operating systems they ran on executable in some virtual environment where the hardware that ran the operating system is being emulated by a virtual machine. If we don't take steps to sort of preserve the operating system software and the application software, we may end up with files whose bits we have available, but we don't know how to interpret because we can't execute the code that knows what the bits mean. So I've been calling this a digital dark age, and I think it's literally a very real hazard. Some of us are already experiencing these problems with digital images that no longer are presentable or renderable because the software that we have available doesn't know what those old formats mean or how they should be presented. So that's a huge area of concern and requires some serious research. And then finally, to pick a third area, I would say that the Internet of Things, which is rapidly coming upon us, is another big issue of how to get that right, how to make sure that the devices that are part of that Internet of Things are safe, that they can't be abused by some nefarious third party, that they can't be invaded in some way for purposes of gathering data about you or your family. I mean, even something as simple as a temperature sensor might be able to convey information about where are people in the house and how many of them are they. Are they awake or are they asleep? So the safety and security and confidentiality of even sensor data may turn out to be a big challenge in this Internet of Things. So those are just three examples of areas where we have serious work to do. It's not a question of just slapping cryptography on top of everything. That's not necessarily the solution. The real problem is deeper than that, and it has a lot to do with how we produce software and how we detect vulnerabilities in it and how we recover from that.
Now, Vinton, this next question, let me give you a list of some areas. Some of them are quite controversial, and I'd like to get your opinion on one or more of them. And the first one is Kurzweil Singularity and maybe the work being done at Singularity University. The second is D-Wave's quantum computing. This idea of quantum entanglement and machine learning, there's just some recent announcements in that area. The Future of Life Institute, where they're talking about mitigating existential threats to humanity and deep learning, impacting labor and humanity. And then some of these rapid advancements in terms of precision genetic medicine, altering the genes of human germ cells, and just a sort of an odd sort of idea, this Ex Machina movie coming out. So what are your views of these and others?
And how many hours have we allocated for answering these questions? I will try for brevity. Ray Kurzweil is a colleague at Google, perhaps. Your listeners might not know that. I think Ray is, it's a stretch for Ray's singularity to happen. It is conceivable that that could happen, that machines would become sufficiently capable that you could somehow measure and upload your consciousness into a machine. The thing is, we don't know what consciousness is. We don't know how it's derived. You know, we have some ideas, but they are certainly not demonstrated at this point. So I think it's an interesting speculation. Singularity University is not solely based on that one singular speculation, though. I mean, it is looking at a wide range of topics. I've enjoyed my time lecturing there and interacting with the students. They explore a very broad range, in some cases, of cosmological ideas. The D-Wave system is in use by Google in cooperation with NASA Ames, and we've already discovered some algorithms that we believe would show the speed-up that one hopes from quantum computing. We're also fairly sure that not all algorithms will necessarily speed up just because they happen to be executed on a quantum machine. So we have a lot to learn still about how to devise those algorithms to take advantage of the nature of quantum computation. There's a controversy over whether D-Wave is true quantum or something else. It's advertised as adiabatic. I don't actually care about the resolution of that question as much as I care about the evidence that some algorithms run a lot faster in the D-Wave environment than they do in a conventional computing environment. And as long as we have examples of that, this is a worthwhile and exciting piece of R&D to pursue. Quantum entanglement is of interest, of course, partly because of the way quantum computing works, but also for the distribution of keys in quantum cryptography environment. And without going into a lot of detail, even though it is not possible to do instantaneous signaling, which is what some people imagine quantum entanglement would do, it does allow you to transmit keying information in such a way that you could detect whether someone is trying to intercept it. And so that may turn out to be a very useful tool in the toolkit for preserving confidentiality. On machine learning, I think we're learning a great deal about how Bayesian mechanisms work, and we've been very successful at Google and elsewhere in applying Bayesian techniques to get machines to adapt to partial information. With regard to existential threats, although I don't know very much about the Future of Life Institute, there is another organization that a former astronaut, Ed Liu, started, which I think is called B612. It is specifically a spacecraft intended to detect near-Earth objects that might actually threaten to cross into our orbit and hit the planet. And since nobody wants a repetition of the dinosaur disaster, it's important that we actually pay attention to, what those risk factors are. So I'm a sponsor and a fan of that work. The other things that you mentioned, the deep learning, and I'll add to that robotics. I think that I'm thinking about the 19th century period when we were going through the Industrial Revolution, and there were people who thought that robots, or at least with machine systems, would take over for all the humans, and that is not what happened. I don't think we're likely to see that in the same way in the robotics world, except to say that there may very well be some sophisticated jobs that machines can do, and that humans may need retraining in order to do a different job and still have good employment, which means that going back to school in some way or other, maybe it's a MOOC, a massive online open course, is going to be an important part of our society. And so the idea that you keep going to school or you go to school whenever you need to learn more should be the norm as opposed to something unusual. Last point on genetic medicine. This is complicated territory. I would say that we are learning an awful lot now about how our bodies work and what goes on inside each cell, which is truly, it's like a downtown Manhattan inside of any given cell is the complexity of what's going on. I'm more or less persuaded that we will understand in a very deep way how a lot of our health systems work, our immune response systems and so on, and that we will learn at some point to respond to serious threats to our health using genetic mechanisms. I think we have to be very conscious of the potential for doing the wrong thing, so we should approach this very, very carefully.
You know, Vint, you've got a remarkable career also as an executive, and are there sort of some events or decision points that you want to share with the audience and you think would be of value to the executives in the audience?
Well, I don't know if they'll be of value to the executives. I hope they'll be of value to some of the younger crowd that are, in fact, trying to make decisions about what careers to go into and, what kind of things to study. So I'll give you a few examples of decisions I made that turned out to be wrong, and I was forcefully corrected. One of them was I left undergraduate school at the end of my bachelor's in mathematics at Stanford and went to work at IBM. That was a good thing to do. I was pleased with that decision. But I was there only 2 years and realized that I needed a lot more information about how computer systems were designed, how the operating systems work, how programming languages worked, and I didn't know the answer to any of those. So I returned to school. That, too, was a good decision. Finished a PhD at UCLA, and then, by an amazing coincidence, was invited to return to Stanford as a member of the faculty, and I said no. Well, I wasn't allowed to say no, and I'm grateful that I was not allowed to say no, but I thought, I've been there as an undergraduate, I know how smart the kids are, I don't have anything to teach them, so, I said no, and they said, you can't say no, and at the end of the day, after many phone calls from people who had written my textbooks, I agreed to come to Stanford. It's a good thing I did, because that's where Bob Kahn and I did our initial work on the design of the Internet, which might not have happened if I hadn't been there. So deciding to join the Stanford faculty after being forced into it, that was a good thing, but I was stupidly reluctant. Then when the Advanced Research Projects Agency wanted me to join them to run the internet projects in Washington, I said no. I said, you have that white stuff there. You call it snow. Other people call it angel crap. And, you know, why would I do that? I'm here in the nice West Coast. But I wasn't allowed to say no there either. And, of course, it's a good thing because that was probably one of the most productive 6 years in my career at ARPA, running the internet program and packet radio and packet satellite and packet security and things like that. And I got to work with Bob Kahn again at ARPA. And then I went to work for MCI in the private sector, and I'm glad I did. We built MCI Mail. We were probably 10 years early in terms of the market. But it was a great experience to be in the commercial sector. And then I rejoined Bob Kahn. And at that point, I was happy to return to research, having pretty much used up all of my research rain barrel doing the systems at MCI. And then later in my career, about 10 years ago, I was invited to join Google. And there's no way to fault that. It's been a terrific ride. There are lots of young people that force you to rethink your positions by saying, why don't we do X? And I'll say, we tried it 25 years ago and it didn't work. And they'll say, yeah, but there's a reason it didn't work 25 years ago, and that reason may no longer be valid. So wake up and, you know, give this further thought, and they are right. So I've been forced to rethink a lot of ideas thanks to the young, energetic folks here who are too young to know you can't do that.
You know, we're down to some of our closing questions, and you wrote a really interesting piece with the ACM with regards to this whole idea of professionalism and perhaps some kind of credentialing. What are your views on that as of this year?
Well, it is a huge debate. Most programmers would prefer not to be told that they have to take a test to write software, and the reaction is, I don't need no stinking test to be a programmer. And they're probably right about that. The real question is, will they be forced to accept more, not only responsibility, but liability for what they do? And up until now, most programmers have been given a free pass with regard to their software. You often look at commercial software and it says, this is not guaranteed to do anything useful. At some point, I think we won't be able to get away with that, at least for some kinds of applications. Now, people have been saying that for quite a while, and we haven't had an event which forces upon at least some of the software community the need to have credentials and to be licensed and to show evidence that they are continuing to improve their programming skills. Unlike other professions like medicine and law, where you have to show that that you're continuously refining your ability in order to retain your license. We know about licensed engineers, and we know that sometimes there are certain tasks that are not permitted, design tasks that are not permitted to anyone other than a licensed engineer. So I know that many of my colleagues don't like this idea very much, but I think that at some point, with the degree of software that we're surrounded by everywhere, that at some point we may be called to task for failing to do something, you know, that protects people's interests, and that there may be liability. And as soon as that happens, I think some forms of accreditation will be inescapable.
You know, this is our last question, and I'll close, and this is, we're going to turn the tables. If you could ask yourself one question, what would it be, and what would be your answer?
How many times have I been asked, what were you thinking when we were doing the internet? Also, they ask, you know, did you have any idea that the internet was going to be this big? Of course, the answer is, well, not exactly. Bob and I were both convinced this was a really powerful technology if it worked. And we had great hopes, although I think we didn't have global aspirations in the way that you might imagine. We were mostly just trying to make sure that this thing actually worked properly. I can tell you that one of the most satisfying aspects of all of this story have been the institutions that have been created at NEED, things like the Internet Architecture Board, the Internet Engineering Task Force, the Internet Corporation for Assigning Names and Numbers, the Internet Society, the Regional Internet Registry. So there's a whole bunch of institutions in the ecosystem of the Internet. And what I like about it is that they were created in a very bottom-up way. You know, they weren't created until it was apparent that they were needed. And there was a very collaborative effort to create these institutions. And this notion of collaboration and cooperation has infused and informed the Internet's design and its evolution. And that continues to this day, 40 years later. So if there's anything truly satisfying about the experience so far, I think it has to do with the way in which people have voluntarily chosen to work together, to collaborate and cooperate in order to keep the Internet running and continuing to evolve. And I can't think of anything more wonderful for an engineer to see his or her ideas not only take flower, but also absorb and make use of the ideas of others. And if the Internet is anything, it is an enabler of innovation. And I can't think of anything more satisfying than that.
Well, Vint, I know you have another interview to go to, a video interview. So thank you for coming in today and sharing so much with our audience.
No, it's a real pleasure, Stephen. I look forward to getting feedback, if there is any, from your listeners.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Vint Cerf, a legendary polymath icon who is continuing to be a catalyst for global innovation and change.